I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Folks, this is a live call-in show today, and our topic is common objections to capitalism. So please call in with your questions at 1-800-313-9443. This is going to be a very interesting show and a lot of fun, too. First, we have our special commentator, Ms. Zoe Russell, with us today. How are you today, Zoe?
I'm good, thank you. Happy to be here.
How's everything down in Houston?
Snowy.
Yeah. How's everything down in Houston?
It's actually snowy, I can't believe
it. Oh, you said snowy?
Mm-hmm.
In Houston?
Well, yesterday.
Oh, my goodness. How do you guys cope with that?
We got out of work early. Everyone had a cow.
Okay. Today, our special guest is Dr. Art Cardin. Welcome back, Art.
Hey, good to be here.
Good. Glad to hear you. Okay. Now, Art is a professor of economics at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. He is also a visiting scholar at a number of institutions, including the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. Those of you who heard our show with Art from last week will remember that we talked about the myths of capitalism's history. Today, we're going to tackle two very important questions. Why is capitalism so unpopular? And what are the common objections to capitalism, and how should these be answered? Now, before we get started talking about capitalism, Art, what I'd like to ask you to do is let's start by defining what capitalism is not. Would you take a crack at that?
Okay, so what capitalism is not? When people hear the word capitalism, they usually get some idea of like these plutocrats and these gigantic top hats who are standing with their boot heels on the neck of the underclass or something like that. But capitalism is not that. Capitalism is not, to quote Deirdre McCluskey, capitalism is not vice incarnate. Capitalism is not greed is good. You know, for those of you out there who've seen Wall Street, you know, it's not greed is good. It's not vice incarnate. It's not a system by which some people exploit and expropriate others. And I think most importantly, capitalism is not $800 billion handed from taxpayers to special interests with no strings attached.
Yeah, so there's no kind of any monopoly privilege in capitalism.
No.
Yeah,
no.
And so if we see government help or helping a company or a person such that it reduces consumer choices or increases consumer prices, that's not capitalism.
No, that is absolutely not capitalism.
What is that?
That's a combination of things. Mises would call it interventionism.
Mm-hmm.
Other people would call it corporatism.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, attempting to establish cartels
mm-hmm.
in certain industries would be an example of interventionism or corporatism.
Now, in history, that has also been called mercantilism.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, mercantilism dealt primarily the key differences I think between mercantilism and corporatism. They were similar. There are a couple of key differences. When I think mercantilism, I primarily think international trade. I think specifically barriers to trade and subsidies to exports.
Okay. And a lot of wars occurred as a result of this concept of mercantilism.
Absolutely.
And so that was a common strategy between France and England and Spain hundreds of years ago. But now we see it here where the government intervenes and gives special privileges in the form of licenses, subsidies, tariffs, and so on and so forth to various different groups. And instead of people focusing on the linkage of government to these businesses, they just focus on the businesses.
Right.
And so we hear a lot of people that are very upset with big business,
mm-hmm.
but big business often really likes big government.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's kind of an iron triangle historically between big business, big government, and big labor.
Okay. Now, unfortunately, our time is flying already. We're going to have to take a short break. We're going to be back in just a couple of minutes.
Okay.
So, folks, stay with us. We're going to come back with Dr. Art Cardin in just a couple of minutes. We're going to be talking about our topic today, common objections to capitalism. Stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. Back to you right after the break. And we're back. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. And we're talking with Dr. Art Cardin with our special commentator, Ms. Zoe Russell. Today we're talking about the topic of common objections to capitalism. So, Art, we were just talking about what capitalism is not, and I'd like to talk about the role of profits. You know, commonly, a lot of people think that profits, the word profits, is a dirty word.
Right.
What do profits do?
Profits are really important in a market economy. They're essential to a market economy. And, in fact, actually, they're essential to almost any type of rational activity. So what profits do in a market economy with no coercion is they give people information about what creates value. They enable rationality. They enable rational economic calculation. And if the quickest and best way to get rich is to produce value for other people, in other words, to build the proverbial better mousetrap or to provide higher quantity or lower prices, then we get sustained economic growth like that we've seen over the last 2.5 centuries. If the quickest way to earn profits, and this is the direction in which I fear we're going in the early 21st century, is to expropriate and redistribute things that don't belong to you, then we get lower growth or even negative growth, which is what we've seen for most of the human experience.
Right. So let's start with the first objection to capitalism that you list in your article, which, by the way, folks, I want to refer everyone to Art's series of articles that are available on the Mises.org website. That's Mises.org. And you can pick up a link to that on our website later. But let's start with this first objection to capitalism that you list in your article, that capitalism exploits the poor. What's wrong with this statement?
So the idea, well, first of all, it's not true. It's absolutely, positively, manifestly not true. It's 180 degrees the opposite of the truth.
Okay.
Capitalism, free markets, and laissez-faire are the best thing that have ever happened to poor people in the history of anything ever. Honestly,
okay.
I don't think that's too much of an overstatement. If you look at the development of capitalist economies, meaning economies based on secure private property rights and uninterfered with free trade, then you see explosions in living standards for the poorest of the poorest of the poor. So, for example, if you look at the benefits of the Industrial Revolution, which is sort of the beginnings of what we would call modern capitalism, conventional treatments would say that, well, those should go to the owners of land, or they should go to the owners of capital. Karl Marx said you'd have the progressive immiseration of the proletariat, meaning basically that the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. The exact opposite is what happened. Returns on land stayed constant. Returns on capital stayed constant.
In other words, the rich class did not get richer.
Right. They did not get richer. They got richer in an absolute sense. They did not get richer in a relative sense.
And so, but the poorest of the poor suddenly had things that they never had before.
Yes, absolutely. The poorest of the poor had amazing things that they never had before. If you look at the data, Gregory Clark is an economic historian, has an excellent book called A Farewell to Alms, An Economic History of the World. There's a beautiful picture, in fact I'm looking at it right now, on page 276, of real hourly wages for building laborers in England. And it stays almost constant from roughly the year 1200 till about the year 1800, and then it explodes. And this is roughly coincident with the period in which England is adopting free market capitalism. For all intents and purposes.
Now, so also what has actually happened as a result of the poorest people actually starting to get income, which they didn't have before, is they actually had something called purchasing power.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
and
so we see...
Go ahead.
Okay, well, we see the development of consumer industries aimed at providing stuff that common people want to have. We see the development of a middle class, first of all. We see the development of markets for consumer durables, second of all.
Okay, so let's just stop there.
Sure.
Because I want you to continue with this, but let's just pause on that for a minute. Most people think the middle class is something that's been eternal.
Right.
And that's not.
Right.
So when did the middle class really start to develop? In other words, it was just poor and rich?
Yeah, for most of history, you've either been very rich or you've been very poor, and it's rare that there's been anybody in between. In the United States, we begin to see the development of a middle class toward the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th centuries, and we see over the course of this very long development that during the early years of the Industrial Revolution and the early years of the American founding, a focus on the part of merchants and producers, not on producing stuff for the upper class, but on producing the sort of mundane things that we find that are parts of our day-to-day lives.
Okay.
Joseph Schumpeter argued that modern capitalist progress, for example, is not more silk stockings for the Queen of England, but more, better, halfway decent stockings for factory workers in England at progressively lower prices.
Yeah, and more choices.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Choices really equate to quality of life.
Yes.
I mean, the more choices we have, the better potential quality of life we have.
Definitely.
The fewer choices we have, the more obvious, poorer quality of life that we have.
Definitely. Definitely.
So let's stop talking about stuff for a minute and talk about mortality.
Right.
You know, I think you brought up this point about infant mortality and maternal mortality as being a minuscule fraction of what they used to be.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, infant mortality is a minuscule fraction of what it's been historically. Maternal mortality, so the probability that a woman would die in childbirth, is a fraction of what it's been historically. I don't have the data in front of me. But
you mentioned that extending this, that the average lifespan during the Roman Empire was 24.
Right.
And 30 right. in Britain at the end of the 15th century, 45 in the United States, actually only a little over 100 years ago.
Right. Yeah. 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 Today, life expectancy is pushing 80. So we have a 16-month-old at home, and we actually have another one on the way. So we're...
congratulations.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. So in terms of what free markets have done for us, it's more than just an academic thing, and it's more than just something that's provided us with a lot of stuff. I can be reasonably certain that both of my kids are going to live to a healthy old age,
mm-hmm.
barring some type of disaster or barring, you know, checkered family medical history rearing its ugly head.
Sure, sure.
You know, let's go to the
next objection, which is that capitalism is structurally racist and sexist. We hear this all the time.
Yeah, and that's also not true. I think, unfortunately, people look at what other people do and then blame it. Often they blame it on the institutions when the institutions are not particularly to blame. I think human beings we're tribalistic, we're racist, we're sexist. We tend to have all sorts of biases that we bring to the proverbial table. None of this was created by free markets.
Yeah, actually, capitalism, punishes sexism and racism.
Exactly. Yeah, capitalism punishes sexism and racism. So a thought experiment that I ask students to do at Mises University is to take two societies that are equal in every respect, and they're both racist, they're both sexist, they're both, for all intents and purposes, they're both societies like what humans have existed in for most of our history. And then you give one of them capitalist institutions and one of them socialist institutions. Since capitalism punishes racism and sexism by providing people who wish to indulge their racism and sexism with lower profits, I would expect that over the very long run, the capitalist society would exhibit much less racism and sexism than the non-capitalist society.
Mm-hmm. So, you mentioned this point about Milton Friedman said about politics and commerce and differences that commerce reduces and harmonizes our differences,
yes.
while politics turns those differences into a source of
exactly.
tension and violence.
Yes, exactly. Because politics—that's what politics is. Politics is embodied violence. I forget who said this. It might have been George Washington. He said, "Government is not beauty. Government is not truth. Government is not eloquence. Government is force."
Right.
It was George Washington.
Yeah.
Ah, good. Great. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah, government is using a gun to force someone else to do something they wouldn't otherwise do.
Uh-huh.
Economics, on the other hand, market exchange is cooperation. It's finding ways to make other people better off.
Right.
Politics is at best a zero-sum game, whereas market exchange is a positive-sum game.
It basically incentivizes, capitalism basically incentivizes us to be cooperative.
Definitely, definitely.
Yes. Now, granting monopolies on force actually or based on governmental force insulates those entities that have those monopolies from these market pressures.
Right.
And,
definitely.
You could could actually see that that might magnify or even insulate them also from racist or sexist tendencies. Well,
right. Yeah, giving someone monopoly power in a goods market or giving someone monopsony power in a labor market. So monopsony is when you have one buyer of a good or service, allows them to indulge those preferences. So, for example, when we have any kind of intervention, whether it be a minimum wage, for example, or rent control or something like that, I, as an employer or a landlord, would no longer be punished as severely for indulging racist preferences.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very important point to remember.
Mm-hmm.
So, by virtue of the fact that if I'm an employer and there's a minimum wage, I have people lined up out, you know, going out the door for the employment opportunities I'm offering, or if I'm a landlord and there's rent control, I have people lined up out the door for the apartments that I have to offer. I can be choosy with who I hire or with who I rent my stuff out to. And if I wish to be racist, then there's really nothing to stop me. And since minimum wages and rent controls and monopoly power and so on and so forth reduce the dynamism of the market, I'm insulated from punishment.
Okay. We're going to interrupt you right now here, Art. We have to break for a couple of minutes. Everyone, please stay with us. We have Dr. Art Cardin with us. We're talking about common objections to capitalism. This is Radio Free Market. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and I have with me today Dr. Art Cardin and our special commentator, Zoe Russell. And we're talking about the common objections to capitalism. And, Art, we were just talking about this one objection of capitalism is structurally racist and sexist, and you were addressing that. During the break, Zoe, you brought up an interesting point. Would you like to bring up your point now?
Mm-hmm. Do you think that everybody should get an equal education so they can have an equal footing when they compete for a job, not based on racism or their race or their sex?
Okay, that raises an interesting question. So first of all, in a competitive labor market, like I said, people are going to be punished for discriminating on the basis of race and gender. In terms of whether people should have an equal education or equal access to education, there are a couple of issues that need to be addressed there. First, there's the idea that education creates what we call positive externalities, which means that if we leave education to the free market will provide too little education because I get benefits from your education that I don't necessarily have to pay for. According to a recent study by Kerry King at Penn State University at Erie, I think the positive externalities from education run out at about third grade. So those externalities are already captured in the amount of education that people would get in a free market. Second, while I support the distributional goal, the questions that we'd have to ask would be, okay, so first of all, what's education? How do we define this good that is education? Whose values matter, and what does it mean for education to be equal? Are we talking about equal outcomes? Are we talking about equal access? Are we talking about equal resources? It's not clear. Those are non-trivial questions that don't have obvious answers. And I would argue further, those are questions that don't have answers that can be found outside the market process.
Okay. So, Zoe, do you have a follow-up on that? Not at this time. You can bring that up later. That's okay. I want to invite Mark from Texas, who's been holding, to address Art with his question. Hello, Mark. Are you there?
Hi. Art, I think capitalism in its truest form is by far the best example of economics that's ever been invented. But I think where it has to be applied in a system or a nation that respects its borders. In a globalist society, which we've turned into after NAFTA, CHAFTA, GATT, you name it, we're going to have a hard time as citizenries accepting a totalitarian system that's coming down on us right now. We can't compete with laborers that work for pennies in other countries. it would be great if we could. I mean, heck, we can't even control our proprietary controls on the patents.
Okay. So, Art, thank you very much for your question, and I'm going to let Art respond to that the best he can. Okay? Thank you very much.
Okay, that's an interesting issue, and that opens a can of worms, because I've written in favor of complete open border immigration and complete free trade in a couple of places. In fact, after reading Lant Pritchett's book, Let Their People Come, which you can download for free from the website of the Center for Global Development, I'm close to seeing open border immigration as being an issue that is to the 20th century what the abolition of slavery was to the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
Almost, it's almost that serious, because if you look at most of the arguments against open borders, one, they're very similar to the arguments that were used to defend slavery, or that were used to argue against abolition in the 19th century. But that's kind of a red herring. That doesn't really matter so much right now. But two, they're also based on unsound economics. So one of the bedrock principles of economics is the law of comparative advantage, which shows that when you have differences between two people, there are opportunities for them to gain from exchange. So, for example, the more stuff that we buy from people in China or India or Europe or Canada or Mexico or whatever, the more we can specialize in what we do well. So, for example, if you own an iPod and you look on the back of an iPod, at the very, very bottom, it'll say designed in California, manufactured in China.
Uh-huh.
So we can focus on designing products that we're very, very good at and outsource some of the manufacturing processes.
Yeah, this is actually two different issues that got brought up by Mark. One is the open border issue. The other is the globalization issue.
Right.
And as far as the open border issue, I see the connection between the two. I personally, having being the progeny of immigrants, mm-hmm. I look at a lot of these people as being refugees, not immigrants per se, and that's my personal prejudice on that. But at the same time, the entire discussion becomes very confused because of the interventions of government,
right?
Because of the different incentives that are given to these people to take advantage of various taxpayer-funded different activities or services. And so the conversation becomes very, very different than it was in the 18th century when people were coming across on boats from Ireland and Europe, and they were able to come over, but when they got there, they had nothing except what they could put together for themselves. So we're going to come back to this conversation. This is a very hot topic. And we're going to come back, and we have another caller waiting to talk to us. This is Radio Free Market. I am your host, Michael McKay, and we'll be back right after the break talking with Dr. Art Cardin and Zoe Russell. Stay with us. Thank you very much. And we're back. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and I have with us Dr. Art Cardin and Zoe Russell. And Zoe, you had another point that you wanted to bring out here on this point we were just talking about.
Right. I think that the right to leave your government would be a great sign to that state that you disagree with how they're doing things and you want to go find better opportunities somewhere else.
Right.
But should we force the people to stay in their own country and create change within their own political system or allow them to come here?
Yeah, there are a couple of things are at issue there. So on one hand, this question about whether say, okay, look, you need to stay in your country and create change in your country. In some of the places that people are trying to leave, you know, quite honestly, one of the reasons why I have the privileges I have is strictly an accident of birth. I was fortunate enough and blessed enough to be born in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that a lot of us would be singing a different tune if we were under the boot heel of an oppressive and tyrannical state.
Mm-hmm.
Political action generally doesn't work very well. That's unfortunate, but it's also true. I think the closest we can come to having something approximating a market for political systems would be, again, like I said, open border immigration and allowing people to, say, to use the economics terminology, to vote with their feet. And say, okay, I don't like the government here, therefore I'm going to move there.
What about the argument that immigrants cause wages to fall?
that's actually not the case. It's true that there might be some spillovers in the form of slightly lower wages for the very, 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 very poor in the United States, but by and large, actually, immigrants either have a neutral effect or a positive effect on American wages, on American tax takes, and things like that. So immigrants, I understand the concern that, you know, people would come to the United States looking for a free ride or what have you, but most immigrants, most of the people who are coming here are not looking for a free ride. They're not looking for a handout. The marginal immigrant is not coming here looking for a free ride or a handout, and will in fact actually make your life better off.
Right.
So.
Well, I also have a prejudice about this because about 20 years ago, I had the opportunity to assist a young man to immigrate into the United States, and he has been a net positive addition to the productivity here.
Certainly.
And I have been overwhelmed by the work ethic that these people bring in.
Oh, sure.
Into the equation, as opposed to what I commonly find here, which is a give me something for nothing more attitude. Let's go on to the next thing. We have another caller that's been patiently holding. This is Leo from Massachusetts. Leo, are you still with us?
Yeah, thank you for taking the call.
Absolutely.
You know, I think you live in sort of an idealized world, but when you start getting down to the real world of what immigration really is, it's forced labor at lower prices, good for the economy. I mean, if that's the way you want to go with things.
What's forced about it, Leo?
Well, they're here and they got to get a job, so they take any job because they're illegal immigrants. I mean, it's a corporate game that's being played on us. And, you know, sure, we get our food a little bit cheaper because we have a lot of immigrants working in hell holes in Arkansas, you know, packing chicken. But the net result is that, as a machinist myself, I remember when I was working in the field, our work was getting shipped overseas. Now, we're shipping over highly technical jobs, and we're depleting the American workforce. So, you know, the next time you have to stand up on your own two feet, you're going to have to go begging to other countries to sell us the products because we don't have the people here to build them. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, candidly, no. I thought
If you were to think from a capital and labor mix standpoint, you'd have a whole different outlook. You're strictly thinking from the owner, the businessman, the entrepreneur. You're not thinking of the technicians, because we're just people to buy and sell whoever's cheapest, you see.
You bring up a very, very good point. We're going to talk about that more in just a minute. Just what is the role of the employer and what is the role of the employee? Because they are very, very different.
Because what you're sounding like is, oh, I can find labor cheaper. Let me go have it made in China. I don't have to pay Americans to do that. You know?
Okay, so let's talk about that. That's great. Leo, I want to thank you for bringing that up. Okay, we're going to talk about that. So, Art, I'd like to just ask you to respond to this from this vantage point. It has been my view that entrepreneurs bring to the equation two things that employees do not. They bring the facility of being able to risk and being able to wait.
Right.
Whereas employees cannot bring those two to the equation. They must not risk, or they have a very limited amount of ability to risk, and they cannot wait. They have to be paid right away.
Well,
and so, really, labor needs entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs need labor. But to the entrepreneur, labor is a commodity. Now, from the labor point of view, they don't want to be looked at as a commodity. My view is that having been both and having still being both,
right,
that's just the way it is. Labor is a commodity, and that's the way it has to be. How do you respond to that?
Well, I'm not sure what definition of commodity is being used here. I know there in Marxian analysis, people talk about commodification, and again, I'm not sold on that having any analytical meaning. If you're talking about a commodity being anything that's traded, then anything.
Yes, that's basically it.
In terms of the the fallacies about what immigration will do to American wages and what free trade will do to American wages, they're exactly that. They're fallacies. And they were exploded over two centuries ago, beginning perhaps most famously with Adam Smith and then with David Ricardo in the early part of the 19th century. We have some short-run transition, and there are going to be real costs associated with increased immigration, associated with increased trade, but these are going to get washed out over the long run, and further, the prices of the goods we buy will be lower. Our real earnings, our ability to use what we earn to buy things that we like, will increase dramatically. Now, Leo made what I think is an important point about the difference between legal immigration and illegal immigration, and this gets to the heart of the what I think is the heart of the matter with respect to the state and the economy. So I've heard a lot of people argue, well, you know, okay, we want immigrants to come over here as long as they do so legally. My ancestors came here legally. Well, that's great because there was no such thing as illegal immigration.
Right. Everybody, you know? There was no such thing at all.
Right. Now we run into a couple of interesting issues that we have to navigate carefully. And on one hand, employers say, Leo, I believe mentioned Arkansas. Employers in places that are receiving a lot of illegal immigrants are going to want lax enforcement of the immigration laws, but they're also going to want to keep it illegal because that gives them bargaining power over the workers themselves. The problem then is not stemming the tide of quote unquote illegals, I think, but of legitimizing what they're doing. Make it a meaningful market. Make contracts meaningful in this setting.
Well, you know, I'm very sensitive to this issue on both sides because I'm sensitive to it on the from the immigrant side of the equation. I live here in Iowa.
Right.
We have a number of meatpacking plants here. We see a lot of Mexican immigrants that come in here. Some of them are legal. Some of them are illegal. And but some of them start restaurants. We have some great restaurants here from these illegal immigrants.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Some of them work as movers or roofers, mm-hmm. and
right.
you know, have done wonderful work for us. And I can tell you, get good wages and
yes.
have their kids. My daughter goes to school with one, and one family that I happen to know are in that category. And
right.
and they are stand-up people. They're
yeah,
good people,
certainly.
And they're contributing to the overall equation. This characterization that they're, taking from other people is simply not true.
Right, definitely, definitely.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I understand this other issue that Leo brings out, and that is that people who have, you know, worked their lives, they've developed a skill, they want some kind of entitlement to that employment. And the harsh reality is that they don't have the entitlement
right.
to that employment.
Right.
In the same way is that the entrepreneur, the boss, does not have any entitlement to any profits unless new sales are made.
Right.
You know, and there is this vast misunderstanding among people in the crafts, as I've seen it, because I grew up on the blue-collar area of Detroit, that they feel that I've commonly seen this, where they feel there's some entitlement to their employment just because of the time and effort that they've spent all their years and loyalty and so on and so forth. But the harsh reality of life is that there's just no guarantee there.
Yeah. Well, let's come back to the question that you asked at the beginning about what capitalism is not, and capitalism is not a naive view that everything is always going to be rosy and that all rising tides will always lift all boats always and everywhere all the time.
Right.
That's certainly not true. So
right.
if you're 55 years old and you lose your job as a result of outsourcing, then yes, you're going to feel some pain, at least in the short run. The question then that I think needs to be asked, the institutional question, is are you entitled to some type of moral relief as a result of circumstances turning against you? And do you have the right to stand between two people and prevent a voluntary exchange between
right.
them?
And are you? Are, is there any right of anyone to appropriate some fund or funds or advantage from someone unwillingly?
Right.
You know, it's the classic William Graham Sumner equation of A and B deciding what C will do for D.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. That is exactly correct. That is exactly correct. And in terms of there are also I think a couple of important issues here. One is one asks who the relevant moral community is. This is a classic biblical question. Who is my neighbor? And it's not immediately clear to me that someone is my neighbor just because we speak the same language or because we have the same skin color, and someone else is not my neighbor because we don't speak the same language or we don't have the same skin color. And further, when you look at international inequalities, if we say that we have a moral obligation to protect high American incomes, which are acquired primarily through the process of what we call rent seeking in economics, which is using the political system to create high incomes for yourself.
Yeah, I like to use the term privilege seeking.
Right. Yeah. I've heard people have used the term privilege seeking. So if we're protecting the very, very high incomes of some Americans, then what we're doing is we're protecting the very high incomes of some of the richest people that the world has ever seen at the expense of the very, very poor, and we're using force to do it. So the economics aside, I find that questionable.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot of unlearning that we have to do in this conversation, and one of the, I think, principal unlearning points is that we have to unlearn this concept that there is a point in life where we don't have to remain flexible, where we may not have to relearn, where we may not have to start over.
Right.
The good life that we have experienced, and I love the good life that we're experiencing. You know, I'd love it to be expanded. But the good life that we do experience does not also include being alleviated from the threat or the possibility
right.
of us having to,
right.
you know, start over. Maybe your job no longer is relevant anymore.
Yeah.
You know, maybe all of a sudden somebody invents a photosynthetic way to produce portable energy and the entire energy industry is completely kaput. Would we stop that?
Right.
We wouldn't stop that. We'd hail that. We'd love that. You know,
yeah,
we should transform humanity, but there'd be an awful lot of people that would have devoted their entire lifetimes to that particular activity, and they would have to relearn.
Yeah.
Start over, essentially.
Certainly. A thought experiment that one of my former mentors, Russell Roberts, who hosts the Econ Talk podcast, has done before is to say, well, would we be better off if Japan shipped us cars for free? If the Japanese decided to buy everybody a Toyota, give everybody a brand new Toyota at a price of zero, okay? Then that's not substantively different from Japan selling us cheap cars,
mm-hmm.
or China selling us cheap steel, or whoever selling us cheap whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, economics is all about cooperation. It's all about cooperation. It's all about people making everybody else better off. And I think in terms of unlearning, an important rhetorical question or an important rhetorical issue that we have to get past is when we say something like, my job. I have a job. I'm employed by Rhodes College, but it's not my job.
Mm-hmm.
As in, I don't have a property right to the job. As in, I can't prevent, you know, legally, presumably, I can't prevent Rhodes from firing me and seeking somebody else. It's not my job in the same way that what I'm holding now is my coffee cup.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. So there was another objection that you wrote in your article that capitalism deadens the soul, and
yes.
This is a good segue into this particular right. question. Doesn't capitalism kind of harden us, deaden our souls in some way?
Yeah. Well, that again is another classic objection, and I think an interesting book that's going to be written in the next 50 years. I think. We're a little too close to it historically for this book to be written now, but is a narrative of the debate over free markets versus socialism. And over the 20th century, people said, okay, well, capitalism is not going to produce the material abundance that socialism will. And then, lo and behold, it turned out that capitalism did.
And socialism
and
people, didn't.
Huh?
And socialism did not.
Yeah, socialism most definitely did not. And then it turned out that, well, and then people said, okay, capitalism delivers the goods, but it deadens the soul. I think in the words of William Wordsworth, he said, in getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. And the argument there is that sure, we have, you know, nice coffee and deep dish pizza and nice computers and baubles and DVD players and things like that, but are we not getting all of that at the expense of high culture, at the expense of our relationships with friends and family? And again, I think the evidence on that points in the direction of capitalism making us better people.
Okay. Now, we have another caller. We're going to try to get to him real quick. This is Joe in Pennsylvania. Joe, are you there? Oh, Joe, I'm going to have to have you wait, and we're going to have to bring you in after the break. We have another break coming in right now.
Okay.
And so please stay with us. And everyone, please stay with us. We have one more segment right after the break. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We're talking with Dr. Art Carton and Zoe Russell on common objections to capitalism. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. And I have with me today Dr. Art Carton and our special commentator, Zoe Russell. And we're talking about common objections to capitalism. And we're taking the break. And Joe, are you still there from Pennsylvania? Yes. Joe, are you there?
We
have a very short segment here, Joe, so if you could make your question kind of brief, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. I enjoy listening to your show. The main thing, and I consider myself a free market person. I would call myself free market rather than capitalist, but at any rate, the reason why I'm against free trade is because there's not a level playing field. China, the government's actually using slave labor to produce their goods. And it's not right to ask our workers who work in a free market system to compete with somebody in a country like China that's oppressed, where they're incorporating slave labor. I mean, literal slave labor, not figurative, where people say, oh, they're paying low wages and call them slave wages. Walter Williams, who I agree with a lot of the things he writes, I don't know if you're familiar with him, and a free market economist himself, he makes the claim that free trade between, say, the United States and China would be the same as between New Jersey and Pennsylvania. But New Jersey and Pennsylvania are not the United States and China. And I'm in favor of tariffs, although not protectionist tariffs, because tariffs are the only legitimate means, or one of the few legitimate means, that the government has to raise the minimum revenue that it needs to actually run the country.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for your comments, Joe. We're going to try to get into a couple of those things. You brought out several things. Art, please address what you can there.
Yeah, very, very, very briefly. That raises a number of very good points. So on one hand, on the tariff issue, if governments have to raise revenue, tariffs are certainly one way to do it. And if they can tax things that cannot be produced domestically, then presumably they can do it while wasting as few resources as possible. On the slavery issue, I would argue that slavery period is incompatible with free trade.
That's
so
right.
what's being described as free trade is not free if slaves right. are being used on one end.
Yeah, slave labor is not the same thing as free trade at all. Yeah.
This is something I hammer for my economic history students: is it always and everywhere slavery is bad. Slavery is bad. Slavery is wrong.
Right.
You know, so on and so forth.
So we're going to have to wrap this up. We're getting close to the end of our show here today. I want to end with this question of, so why is capitalism so unpopular?
Well, Henry Hazlitt said that the important ideas have to be relearned every generation. And I think economics is shot through with important ideas, a lot of them that happen to be counterintuitive for the average person. So, for example, the law of comparative advantage that I mentioned earlier is not necessarily intuitive, but it's important, and quite frankly, I believe it's correct. It's also important to note that for a lot of the people who are engaged in public commentary, capitalism doesn't flatter their conceit. So to borrow from Adam Smith, capitalism doesn't flatter the conceit of the man of system, as he said. So someone who thinks he or she can design society. If you show that, well, lo and behold, if you leave people to their own devices, And if you don't try to interfere with their voluntary decisions, they will be better off than you can make them. Quite honestly, for someone who considers himself a prospective wise ruler of society, that's not a particularly attractive idea.
Right. Well, folks, what's going to happen here is that we're going to have Dr. Arkart back. Because we got through less than half of the material that we were hoping to in this particular show. So look for Art to be coming back again. We'll have a part two to this show of common objections to capitalism and why is capitalism so unpopular. But for today, I would invite you to listen to this particular show again on our archive at radiofreemarket.com, as well as check out our other educational resources. And we look forward to hearing from you on our website and talking to you again next week. So for everyone at Radio Free Market, Zoe and Megan and me, I'd like you to have a very nice day, and thank you, Art, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Talk to everyone again soon.